On November 5th, 1986, Scott Macklem, the son of the mayor of Croswell, Michigan, was fatally shot in the parking lot of St. Clair County Community College. A fingerprint was pulled from a box of shells at the scene. Some students described the potential getaway car as a red or tan sedan, but no one had gotten a good look at the shooter. One student, Rennie Gobain, intent on involving himself, submitted to hypnotherapy in order to recall the license plate number, but it didn't return any results. Eventually, the victim's alleged fiancé, Crystal Merrill, pointed authorities in the direction of her ex, Temujin Kensu. Even though the fingerprints didn't match and credible alibi witnesses placed Temujin over 400 miles away, authorities put his photo in a very suggestive lineup. And again, Rennie Gobain came to aid investigators with an identification. Temujin's rock-solid alibi and the lack of any physical evidence connecting him to the crime was overcome by Rennie Gobain's dubious identification and a character assassination campaign that should have been inadmissible. The jury was made to believe that Temujin was a satanic, sex-crazed ninja assassin capable of mind control. And although deeply in debt, he was somehow still able to arrange an undocumented private round-trip flight to commit a murder allegedly over a woman who he no longer cared to be within 400 miles of. The prosecutor, Robert Cleland, is now a federal judge. Temujin is still in prison, and the current attorney general, Dana Nessel, who was elected in part to start a conviction integrity unit, refuses to end this well-recognized injustice. This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I gotta say, I'm flabbergasted at what we're about to do today. It's just nuts. I mean, this case, the case of Temujin Kensu, is like a masterclass in the failings of our criminal legal system and our social system as well, by the way. But the criminal legal system is on full display in all of its terrors. And this particular case is in Michigan, but to be fair, it could have been in any state. But here to help us tell this story is the man who's been working his butt off to get Mr. Kensu out of prison. And I'm talking, of course, about Imran Syed, who is the co-director of the Michigan Innocence Clinic and a professor at Michigan Law School. Imran, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
And now we are honored to be joined from a Michigan prison by Temujin Kensu. Temujin, thanks for calling in.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you to all the listeners out there, too.
Now, Temujin, you've been in prison since before probably a lot of our listeners were even born, and it pains me to say that. It's really insane. But when they hear about the maniacal developments in this case, which should have had nothing to do with you, because you were over 400 miles away at the time of the murder, and provably so, I'm going to imagine that they will feel exactly the same way. But first, tell us about your life before all of this happened.
I was born in Flint, Michigan in 1963. My parents separated when I was very young, around 3 or 4 years old. From that point on, my mother became very resentful towards me, kind of that story, you know, you're your father in every possible way, whether it was the good or the bad. And it became a very violent household, a very abusive household. You know, I was not going to strike my mother back, so I basically got pounded a lot. It became physically apparent what was going on. I ran away a couple of times, and eventually I wound up in the Reach Foster Program in Flint until I returned home for the last time at about 15. And by the time I was 16, I was gone for good and living with my grandmother and pretty much raising myself.
Now, Temujin, that wasn't always your name. I mean, you were born Fred Freeman, but you later received the name Temujin Kensu from your Buddhist instructor, right? And later officially changed it while you were in prison. But your fascination with Eastern philosophies and disciplines had roots in your formative years, mostly because of learning martial arts to block all of the attacks that had been coming your way.
You caught that. Yeah, that's true. I was getting pounded a lot. And as I said, I wasn't going to strike my mother. And I was at the drive-in when I was probably 9 or 10 years old. And I saw a movie and I saw this martial artist just blocking every blow that was thrown at him. I also lived in a very violent area. And I saw this way to defend myself. You know, I learned to block and duck and, you know, jump out of the way and all the magical things we see in martial arts movies. And I said, I'm going to learn to do that.
And you really excelled at martial arts, from what I'm told. And so much so that you were invited to live and train in Korea. Wow. But your mother would not allow it. You also excelled academically and went into the military after high school. But despite excelling there as well, Shin splints from your years of martial arts training kept you from moving up in ranks, and which, of course, kept you at the minimum pay through your 4 years there. And that, coupled with some reckless spending as a young man, which, again, I can relate because I did it too, you started racking up some debt. Now, you were honorably discharged and moved to Washington State, where you had a child with a woman named Galen. And then at some point, you lost your job and, out of desperation, wrote some overdraft checks to cover your debts, thinking that you just pay the fees and get the collectors off your back. But you ended up getting prosecuted for theft by the Czech insurance company. You didn't go to jail, but you were put on probation.
Yes, I had written some bad checks. I deliberately overdrafted my account when I was in Washington State between 1982 and 1983. Now, just so everyone understands, and I'm not defending what I did, I was charged with what they call first-degree theft out there, and I was placed on probation, so no prison or anything like that, and agreed to, you know, pay everything back. And I'd actually already begun to do some volunteer work for some of the businesses. Actually, I paid off my entire balance while I'd been in prison on this bit, about $5,600.
So you made good on it, but the point of bringing it up is to show that you were both struggling financially, and now the system had its hooks into you. So you were on probation in Washington. Your daughter's mother decided to head back to Michigan, and you eventually lost custody. You had a few probation violations. They're almost impossible to avoid, but somehow Washington State agreed to let you go back to Michigan, where you looked up a high school sweetheart named Michelle Woodworth. You two connected, had a son, but you also had an open relationship. Now, you lived together in a cabin in Ann Arbor along with your childhood friend, Tom Ford. You were working, studying martial arts and Buddhism, very much into health and nutrition at the time. You rode a motorcycle, wore a leather jacket. And to round out this picture, I also understand that you were the lead singer in a couple of bands back in the day.
You know, I don't want to brag, but I was a pretty good singer. It was a dream when I was young in that horrible life at home to get out, maybe through music.
And I don't think it'll surprise anyone that a lead singer can be popular with the ladies, right? There's a long history of that. I think it's why people become lead singers sometimes. But anyway, there was one young lady in particular named Crystal Merrill from the Port Huron area, which is a short drive from Ann Arbor. And she became part of the reason why we're having this discussion today. But let's back up a bit here. So you and Michelle Woodworth, as I mentioned, had an open relationship. So you were seeing other women. It wasn't a secret to her. And to put a fine point on how long ago this was, you met Crystal Merrill at a video store.
So I was looking at some musical equipment in the music store, and I went into the video store, and there was a girl in there, and that was Crystal Merrill. She started hitting on me. And I was young, and I was, you know, pretty susceptible to that kind of positive attention. And she's like, oh, let me take you out to dinner, and I'll pay for everything, and blah, blah, blah. And, I went for it, and I went out with her. We wound up having physical relations. We went out several times. She became obsessive. She was trying to change my clothing. She was trying to get me to change my hair, get rid of my motorcycle, stop wearing a leather jacket, stop singing rock and roll. It just went on and on. She was basically trying to sculpt me into the man that she wanted me to be. So she liked, let's say, 6 things about me and didn't like 10 things about me. One day she comes with a bag full of Izod shirts. You know, this is the 80s, those pink and lime green with a little alligator. So I'm like, I'm not wearing this. I've got on like an Iron Maiden t-shirt and a leather jacket and shredded jeans, you know?
Right. You're a rock and roll guy. I mean, you weren't trying to hang at the country club with Chad and Blake and wear penny loafers, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Oh my God. I swear, I used to say she wanted me to be Blake.
That's hilarious.
And I'm like, listen, you don't like anything about me, okay? You don't like my hair. You don't like my clothes. You don't like anything about me. I don't want to be with you. She started stalking me and driving by.
And I understand there was a boiling point where she made some dramatic public spectacle at a party, and your friend Tom became concerned about how Crystal's erratic behavior could be dangerous considering your probation status. Once the system gets its hooks into you, you have to fly so straight, you have to thread such a needle and be like goody two-shoes just in order to stay out of prison. And you had already had another minor brush with the law in Pleasant Ridge, Michigan. So the three of you packed up and moved to Escanaba, which is way the hell up in the Upper Peninsula, over 400 miles from Port Huron, where Crystal was licking her wounds. And from what we understand, after you left, she got involved with some other men and got pregnant. Now, one of those men turned out to be the victim in this case, Scott Macklem, and he was the son of the mayor of Croswell, Michigan. And Crystal later claimed that they were engaged and that her unborn child was also his, but we're not even sure if that's true. And it was your previous fling with Crystal that became the basis for the state's theory for your alleged motive. But what seems way more compelling, which is something that the police never investigated, was some of Scott's entanglements in the lead up to November of 86.
prior to his being killed, supposedly he got in some kind of a car chase. All these things are happening to this guy. He had a job in some kind of a men's clothing store, George Innes Menswear. And there are multiple incidents of these two guys coming into his workplace, according to witnesses from the store. And I have the reports. If anybody wants to see them, we'll share them with you. And it says he knew these guys on site. And there were two of them. And it said the first time they came in the store, he had a confrontation with them that almost became violent. And it says he challenged them to fight. It says the second time they came in the store and he saw them, he was so scared he ran in the back of the store and he hid. So whatever happened from the first incident to the second, he was terrified of these guys. The morning that he was murdered at the college, according to people there, he was in the college for some reason. Nobody knows why. Sub-zero morning in November of 1986. But he skipped his classes. But he was in the school with his gym bag, but he never went to gym. We have his college records. He was skipping more and more and more of his classes. And we know now it's because he had a drug problem and he was also dealing drugs at the college. And we found multiple dealers that have confirmed this. So I want people to know that I'm not just saying this. Whatever his family says, they knew he had a drug problem. We found dealers that knew his father, that his father was paying off his drug debts.
So Scott was in trouble. I mean, his wealthy father, the mayor, had tried to save him several times. And you can see how this could have been very embarrassing for a local politician like him, especially back in the 80s when attitudes about drug use were informed by the colossal public policy failure known as the War on Drugs. That same policy also created the environment in which violent crimes like this one occurred. And that brings us to the morning of November 5th, 1986, when Scott had been at the community college, curiously cutting class while carrying a gym bag while not going to the gym. There were also reports that he appeared to be running from the student center to his car when this tragic incident occurred around 9 a.m. Imran, can you tell us a little bit about this?
It's a tragedy, of course. A man was shot and killed in a community college parking lot in Port Huron, Michigan. You know, he was kind of shot near his car.
He's seen running out of the student center. The witnesses said he was running from the student center to his vehicle and then was shot somewhere in front of his vehicle and made it to the front left tire of his vehicle where he fell.
So the assailant fired a shotgun once at Scott Macklem, leaving him on the driver's side of the car. The key was still in the door. One shell casing and a box of shells were found at the scene. A latent print was pulled from the box of shells, and the murder weapon was never recovered. So this is a busy, bustling community college parking lot. And you would think somebody would have seen something, right?
No one saw the actual shooting itself. At least no one has come forward that saw the actual shooting. So the case was built through the testimony of people that saw things that happened kind of a little bit before or right afterwards. One of the witnesses said that he heard the gunshot and kind of as he was looking around, he saw a car driving away kind of fast. And, you know, he had only got a fleeting look at the person.
Right. This was Rennie Gobain, who said that he heard what sounded like a tire had blown out, which caused him to notice a light tan foreign hatchback style car leaving the lot. There's no certainty about whether this car was even connected to the crime, but nonetheless, he saw this alleged assailant through the windshield as he drove by, wearing a dark blue ski cap, not covering his face. But according to Gobain, his head was tilted down the entire time, so Gobain didn't even get a good look at this alleged assailant. Now, Rennie Gobain wrote down a license plate number and reported it to police, but the number didn't turn up a match. So Gobain was then hypnotized by his psychology professor in order to try to better recall the plate number. I mean, this is just embarrassing. And the results were about as probative as one might think. Now, Rennie Gobain also initially said that the car was a foreign hatchback, but later inexplicably and suspiciously, I would say, changed his description to a Ford Escort station wagon. Now, this change, curiously, happened after an anonymous tip came in saying that the alleged assailant had just been spotted driving one. Curiously, again, that tip came in after Temujin had already been arrested. So why did Gobain change this initial description to a very specific and conflicting description that matched an anonymous tip? And was that anonymous tip even real? We don't know the answers to either of those questions, but we can certainly speculate that Gobain had been fed more information by investigators. But anyway, back to the immediate aftermath. So there was also this other witness named Richard Krueger, who was even further removed from the scene and any meaningful information than even Gobain was, right?
He had just seen a man that he deemed suspicious loitering nearby, near some bushes in an adjoining parking lot. And that was about an hour before the shooting.
Right. So not so helpful at the time, until both Rennie Gobain and Richard Krueger both viewed a very suggestive photo lineup. And the suggestion to both of these witnesses was to pick Temujin Kenzo. And we'll get into how it was suggestive in just a bit. But first, how does this photo even find its way into this lineup? Because early on in the investigation, before these eventual misidentifications from Gobain and Krueger, Temujin wasn't even on Port Huron Police Department's radar. How did he even become a suspect living over 400 miles away in the Upper Peninsula?
Mr. Kenzo initially becomes a suspect because in talking to the victim's girlfriend, they find out that he was a former boyfriend of the victim's then girlfriend, Crystal Merrill. And she describes him as a, you know, a curious person, let's say, someone who's into martial arts, someone who she said was, you know, an aggressive type and was very jealous of her and all of that stuff. So that gets police really interested in Mr. Kenzo. They start investigating him. They find that he's living in Rock, Michigan, near Escanaba in the Upper Peninsula, which is a whole different world from Port Huron. But they don't let that stop them. They start trying to figure out how he could have come down from Escanaba, committed the shooting, and been back.
So they investigated Temujin's whereabouts to find a way to nail him, not knowing that they were just going to actually solidify his alibi. They found out that he was on a date until, I believe, around 2 a.m. with a woman named Beth Steyer, and his car had actually broke down and he got help, and then he went home to Michelle Woodworth even later. Meanwhile, the shooting occurred at 9 a.m. over 400 miles away. Temujin was then seen by folks all over town that very day, including at a dojo in Escanaba around noon. Importantly, not everyone at the dojo liked Temujin. He was a cocky 20-something-year-old guy, but despite any of that and their own animosities towards him, they still corroborated his alibi.
The evidence, even at the time of the investigation, was very clear that Mr. Kenzo was not at the scene of the crime, that he was, in fact, at least 400 miles away in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. A distance it would have taken him, I think, something like 7 or 8 hours to drive each way at the time.
So even the prosecution accepted that this round-trip journey in that time frame was not possible by car. And we'll talk later about how they came up with a preposterous travel theory involving a private plane of which there is no record, right? No aviation logs, nothing. Just to try to make his guilt plausible for a jury, not that they ever proved it at all. I mean, the only physical evidence, the fingerprint on the box of shells, clearly excluded Temujin, whose alibi was as good as any we've ever seen.
There's more to this too, Jason. So remember, there's no Scott when Crystal and I are together. So there's no reason to be jealous of this guy. I knew about an Arnell Hope. I knew about a Mike Van Dyke. There was no Scott. Secondly, the Scott guy has done nothing to me. Third, I've moved far away. I've got girlfriends up north. I'm trying to get this record deal. I'm living with Michelle in this dumpy little farmhouse, trying to live my singing dream. I'm not going back down. Tom Ford confirmed that we never went back down, that we never stalked Crystal or stalked Scott or anything. Again, you know, a lot of the listeners right now are young and they're used to the present technology. There was no internet in my day. There were no cell phones in my day. He was killed at college skipping class on a sub-zero morning in Port Huron. How the hell could I have known this guy was going to college? There's no way I could have done all this detective work. You know, I was stone broke. Michelle was on welfare. I was even more poor by the time we were living up north. There's no way for me to gather all this data about Scott.
Right. You'd have to have known where Scott Macklin was going to be and when in order to pull this off and make your return flight to the Upper Peninsula to be seen by noon. It's not like you could have found out information about his class schedule online. There was no online at the time. So instead of seeing the writing on the wall that you were not the guy, but rather run down some of the potentially embarrassing leads involving the shady characters connected to the victim, who was the son of a wealthy local politician, they made you the fall guy, the patsy for this murder. And in order to do so, they went back to Rennie Gobain and Richard Krueger with this super suggestive photo lineup. And we'll share this photo lineup on our socials, along with what was then shown to you, the judge, and the jury, to deliberately misrepresent that the lineup was not suggestive. We'll have it all linked in the bio.
They show Gobain and Krueger a photo lineup in which they include Mr. Kenzo's photo And what isn't disclosed to the defense, the judge and the jury, is there are a number of ways in which they clue the witnesses in that they want them to identify Kinsu. Much later, Herb Welser discovered the photos as they were shown to the witnesses, and we found that there were a lot of differences between all the photos on one side and Mr. Kinsu's. Kinsu was the only one who was looking in the opposite direction in his profile view. He was the only one wearing a placard of a different city. He was the only one who had a striped background. His photo was the newest and clearly like stuck out from all of the others. All of these elements that would have biased the witnesses into identifying Kinsu were just not known at the time of trial.
And we spoke with Herb Welser, who is a retired detective lieutenant from the Port Huron Police Department. And after hearing local investigative reporter Bill Proctor's coverage of this case, he felt compelled to get involved.
My name is Herb Welser. I'm retired from the Port Huron Police Department, and I was with the department for 31 years. And then I retired as detective lieutenant. I was there my final 3 years. I was in charge of the detective bureau. In 2007, Bill Proctor and myself, along with Fred Freeman's wife, Amiko, were allowed into the Port Huron Police Department. This is after I retired. Lieutenant Jim Jones, who was a very good man, he took over my position as detective lieutenant. Jim invited us to come in and look at the evidence. And one of the first things that we found is the five original photographs that were shown to the witnesses. There's like 10 or 11 things that are different about Fred Freeman's picture from the Pleasant Ridge Police Department compared to the other four of the Port Huron Police Department. And I thought to myself, the only way that they could have ever got this admitted into court is probably to crop everything out of the photograph other than the facial view of the person. And when this case went to trial, there was a Exhibit 26. It was a poster board that showed the pictures that were shown to the witnesses. For years and years, Fred Freeman and his supporters kept filing FOIA requests for Exhibit 26 to see what it looked like. And they kept getting responses as that this is no longer available. It's been destroyed. So in 2007, Exhibit 26 is still missing. So about 2 months later, Jim called me and he said, Herb, I found the Exhibit 26. And I was just so sad to see that they cropped out everything out of those original five photographs other than the facial view, and that's what they showed in the courtroom. And it's in the testimony. Bob Cleland said to the sergeant, Sergeant John Bounds, he said, are these the original photographs that you showed to the witnesses? And he testified, yes, they are.
At the time of trial, as far as the judge and the jury knew, the witnesses picked Mr. Kinsu out of a fair lineup. We have these two witnesses who identify Kinsu through a very biased lineup. And really, you know, they didn't see the shooting.
Right. They hadn't seen the actual shooting. And Gobain got a fleeting glimpse at best of someone driving away with their head down. And we're not even sure that that was the actual shooter. So the biased lineup let them know who to pick. In fact, when shown live lineups later, only Rennie Gobain even remembered who to pick. Kruger picked someone else entirely. Nonetheless, on November 13, 1986, just over a week after the murder, they arrested you, Temujin, and searched your house, found zero incriminating evidence, no guns, no ammo. Of course, they eventually used all of your martial arts weapons as evidence against you at trial, even though the cause of death had nothing to do with martial arts. So when they took you in, did they try to coerce a confession, as we often see?
I was never interviewed. I was never questioned. They literally arrested me and threw me into a cell. And I said, is anybody even going to talk to me? Well, what I was told was that road officers were like, the whole way down, he was saying he didn't do it. He was telling us where he was that day, that 20 people saw him, that he can prove he was completely innocent. And I think they were terrified. Remember, they already decided to make me the patsy. They decided to make me the fall guy. They'd been putting out lies to the press saying they had witnesses who saw the murder, the whole nine yards. It was all lies. Of course, they didn't have any of that. And then by then, they had, you know, Rennie Gobain already willing to set me up. They refused to sit down and interview me because they had to record the interview and there'd be a record and probably me talking about my alibi and how I was innocent. So they went and told the prosecutor, he's been saying all the way down the car he's innocent, he can prove it. And they put me back in the max section of the jail before they put me in the isolation area. And they refused to talk to me.
So no police even bothered to interview you. And you were an indigent defendant, So you weren't going to make bail, no matter what number they set it at. You had no money. And you had this court-appointed attorney, a former prosecutor named David Dean, who we later found out was not only, get this, a good friend and the attorney for the lead detective in this case, John Bounds. He was defending him in a criminal investigation for his potential involvement with drugs in Port Huron. But then get this, David Dean was also compromised through his own drug addiction.
My lawyer was a former prosecutor from St. Clair County. By 84, he was severely addicted to crack cocaine. By 85, he had a cocaine conviction in Ohio and was on probation in Michigan, overseen by my trial judge. He was under investigation by the drug task force in town, and he was undercover informant, and he was doing drugs with the police. Now, this is all a matter of record. He was eventually disbarred for lying to the bar about his drug use, and because he was observed going into crack houses on 19 separate occasions. They knew all of this about this guy. This is the lawyer they gave me.
The more I look into your case, it seems like the only reason why you're still in there is because the official misconduct, it's so rampant that there would seemingly be no end to the potential civil litigation if they freed you, as they should, and they've known this all along. I mean, I think if you waived your right to civil litigation, they might let you out tomorrow. That's just my theory. I don't know. You know, while looking into your case, my research became more about investigating the state's wrongdoing than it ever was about what happened to Scott Macklem. So let's get back to their wrongdoing. First, they offered you plea deals, but you were already and always adamant about your innocence, so they tried another route to get you to submit to a plea.
I was taken out of population early into my time in the jail and placed in what was called L cell, which is an isolation cell in the back of the jail in a hallway. The cell was a freezing cold in the winter. They would open the security window in front of the cell, so it's like 20, 30 below outside. There was a blizzard at that time, and they would freeze me out in the cell. They turned the water off in the cell, so I literally had to drink water out of a toilet. I wasn't allowed to shower. I wasn't allowed to go to recreation. I wasn't allowed to have any books. They took away my visits. I wasn't allowed any personal phone calls. And all my attorney calls were monitored. And you probably know that's illegal. And we actually had the logs showing where they listened to my attorney calls and what was discussed the few times that I was allowed to talk to my attorney, who was, as you know, in on all this and a former prosecutor. So their plan to break me was part of the scheme they had going with my attorney where they would keep bringing me these deals. And, of course, I refused this.
So you're sticking to your innocence, and at this point, all they had was Renny Gobain's dubious identification. Now, remember, Krueger didn't pick Temujin out of the live lineup, just the suggestive photo lineup that they purposely misrepresented to you, the judge, and the jury. Considering your alibi, it appears that they thought they needed some other nonsense to bolster their case. What else did they do?
The one other piece that we haven't addressed so far is the jailhouse informant, supposedly hearing Kensu confess to committing this crime. And then apparently in this confession, Kensu also told him, plus I have this great alibi that involves many witnesses from the Upper Peninsula. This is clearly just either the informant at his own initiative or at the direction of someone has, you know, tried to take out two birds with one stone. He confessed to me and he confessed to fabricating an alibi. The jailhouse informant at the time said he was doing this just out of the goodness of his heart. Later on, he would admit that he was doing it to obtain benefits in exchange. He admitted that in an affidavit. Later, he recanted in a videotape interview with an investigative reporter in the Detroit area. Basically said he was just doing it to benefit himself. And as far as he knew, Kensu hadn't done anything. Kensu certainly didn't confess to him. That informant's name was Philip Joplin, who unfortunately has now passed away. But he did, as I said, fully recant before he passed away.
Philip Joplin, a long-term con with about 30 felonies and probably 50 misdemeanors. Been in and out of prison. He was also a past informant, and he'd been snitching for years with the drug task force and to the police and on his other criminal cases. I'm never in a cell with other prisoners, so I know something's going on. This guy keeps asking about my case, and he's asking a lot of confidential questions. So I'm on my guard the entire time. I tell my lawyer what's happening. He's like, oh, I wouldn't even worry about it. I said, no, something's going on. My lawyer knew Philip Joplin was an informant and had even been involved in some of his cases when he was a prosecutor. That's how crooked they are. Well, sure enough, here comes this long letter from Philip Joplin saying, I confess to everything in the holding cell.
And although it appears that your lawyer may have known what was going on, but said nothing, of course, any benefit to Joplin was not made known to you or the jury, right?
No, of course not, no. And what we also didn't know was a secret deal had already been made. Philip Joplin was facing what's called a habitual offender sentence, or life in Michigan. The secret deal involved him basically having his charges dropped. The CO was made with my judge. There's handwritten letters saying strong recommendation from Judge Corden. He wants this done right away.
Judge Corden, your trial judge, the same one overseeing your lawyer's cocaine probation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so weird that your lawyer never brought up what he knew about Philip Joplin to you or the jury on cross-examination. So let's get to the trial. It's about 6 months after the arrest. Temujin, you had endured this torture process in jail to get you to submit to a deal, which you courageously resisted. We've just talked about the nonsense snitch testimony that they presented, and you've got this literal joke of a public defender who's aware of this informant Joplin from other cases from when he was a prosecutor. It just gets worse and worse. So Imran, please give us a run through of everything else that happened at trial.
So we've already discussed most of the evidence that the prosecution presents, which is, you know, these two witnesses, one who says, I saw a guy loitering in the bushes, identified him as Kensu. Another who said, I saw a guy driving away after the shooting and identified him as Kensu. Both got really fleeting looks at this person. And as I said already, both had identified Mr. Kensu out of a very egregiously biased lineup, but the jury and judge were not told that. And then the other evidence that the prosecution presents, and the reason this trial is incredibly long, is they put in a whole bunch of character testimony that absolutely is inadmissible, that courts later have agreed should have been inadmissible, but Kensu's lawyer didn't object. And so the most egregious is the testimony of his ex-girlfriend, who describes a lot of things that make Kensu seem like a bad guy, but have absolutely nothing to do with this case or with him shooting anyone ever. So that's the definition of, you know, unduly prejudicial evidence that our system endeavors to keep out of the courtroom, because jurors, being human beings, we're taking the risk they'll convict someone because they don't like him, as opposed to because there's evidence they committed the crime. And in my mind, there's no doubt that the jury convicted Mr. Kensu because they didn't like him, because there was all of this evidence brought in that he was, you know, abusive to people in his life, that he had committed largely petty crimes in the past. And this whole narrative was painted of him as a manipulative, mind-controlling person, which is obviously entirely irrelevant to whether he shot a guy in a parking lot. But this whole narrative includes weapons being brought in that are supposedly the kind of weapons that a ninja warrior would use, because they try to paint Kensu as a wannabe ninja master who can control people and all of that stuff. So there's throwing stars and nunchucks, and all of those are just kind of brought in and put on a table at the trial. They have absolutely nothing to do with a guy getting shot in a parking lot, right? But it's a distraction, and it's kind of just painting Kensu in the eyes of a jury as an outsider, as someone you wouldn't like if you met. And, you know, unfortunately, that ended up working, because the actual evidence of guilt was very, very tiny.
Robert Cleland's entire story about this case was fabricated. It wasn't based on any evidence or any witnesses. It wasn't based on any experts or any forensics. He just made it up. So when he made up the crazy story about wanting to recruit Crystal into my ninja organization, the media was actually beginning to mock him and say, this is stupid. This doesn't make any sense. Then he changed it to jealous boyfriend. So now I'm a jealous boyfriend. You know, they didn't really use the word stalker as much back then. And of course, we know that wasn't true too. And Crystal never even implied that.
So, you know, that's the masterful supposedly case that the prosecution has built, which has very little weight and is largely filled in with completely prejudicial, irrelevant, inadmissible evidence. But, you know, that's what the jury ended up believing. In response, you know, Kensu presented several witnesses, none of whom were his friends and family. They were people that were largely independent, people he associated with, you know, the owner of a store or a guy he met at a Kmart when his car broke down that day. And so I think this alibi probably had a big impact.
Yeah, with all of these independent witnesses, his alibi was formidable. It was airtight. And this brings us to the ridiculous theory that they used to overcome it.
So on rebuttal, the prosecution comes up with this theory that theoretically he could have chartered a private plane, committed the crime, you know, flown back and forth, and no one would know. There was never any record that any such flight took place. There was no showing that Mr. Kensu, who at the time was indigent, even had money to make this happen.
Yeah. I mean, poor people always fly private, right? Yeah. Can you imagine this scenario in real life? He somehow finds the private jet department at his local airport
in the middle of nowhere, and then convinces this random pilot who's just hanging out to not make any record of the flight. Of course, it's all made plausible by his being a ninja who's capable of mind control. But let's just say that he's able to accomplish all of that, which is obviously batshit insane. He's still got to pay for it. Up until this point, he would have had to have been hiding his vast wealth while drowning in debt and living in poverty. But even if he was secretly wealthy, he must have blown it all on the private jet because he certainly wasn't spending it on his defense attorney. So when we spoke to Herb Welser, he pointed out some things about this charter plane theory and the pilot, Bob Evans, who testified at trial to bolster this theory. And somehow it gets even worse from here.
I met with the detective that was under the sergeant, Detective Harry Hudson, and I talked to Harry about 3 hours one night about this case. When we got to the airplane theory, Harry said to me, he says, "Well, Herb, you know who the airplane pilot was, don't you? That is Bob Cleland's personal airplane pilot. Bob Cleland was running for attorney general here in the state of Michigan, and in fact had just lost the election the day before this murder. He lost the election on Tuesday. On Wednesday morning was the murder. But he said Bob Evans is the pilot who would take Bob Cleland to his speaking engagements here in the state of Michigan while he was running for attorney general." And of course, it didn't come out in the testimony.
You know, even having spoken about this case hundreds of times, I am still shocked at how nonsensical all of this is.
So despite the fact that all the physical evidence was exculpatory and that your alibi was rock solid, they stacked up this character assassination campaign that should have been inadmissible and invented this ridiculous charter plane theory to support the one tiny bit of evidence that mattered, the misidentification from Rennie Gobain, who had caught this fleeting glimpse, or said he did, of an alleged assailant with his head tilted downward in a car that we're not even sure was the shooter's. And then when presented with this unduly suggestive photo lineup, he chose your picture and said that you looked like the driver of that car. Then the prosecution purposely misrepresented to you, the judge, and the jury just how suggestive that lineup was. So Gobain's testimony, then the nonsense snitch testimony, along with a bunch of irrelevant bullshit like the testimony from Crystal Merrill, your martial arts weapons collection, the mystery around you being some sort of a ninja, the fact that you had children by two different women and enjoyed an open relationship with Michelle Woodworth, seeing all of that, it seems like the jury was more convinced that they just didn't like you rather than that you had committed this crime. So when the jury came back in, take us back to that moment, that horrible, horrible moment when they convicted and sentenced you to life without parole.
Jaw hit the floor. I couldn't believe it. I literally almost fell over. And I turned to him and said, "I didn't do this." And I turned to the judge and said, "There's no way you can believe that I did this, Your Honor." I said that at my sentencing, too. "There's no way you can believe that I committed this crime. You watched this whole trial. There was no evidence I had anything to do with this. I never even met this guy." MDOC policy required you had to be at least 27 years old to go to the state prison of Southern Michigan. I was 23. In violation of that policy, Robert Cleland had made demands on the MDOC that they place me in Jackson. Jackson at that time was the world's largest walled prison, and it was also one of the most violent. Two corrections officers were killed the year that I came down, Josephine McCallum and Jack Budd. Jack Budd was killed in front of me, by the way, December 27th, I believe it was, 1987. It was insanely violent. I watched a man killed over a 25-cent what we call a shot of coffee, a little tablespoon of coffee. I mean, it was crazy violent. And I was the ninja killer, and I had been in the press. So everybody had to try me. And so when I got to Jackson, I knew my life was in danger, and I was attacked while I was still in what's called quarantine. I was able to defend myself, fortunately, and after that, I began to just train furiously. I thought, I'm going to die in this place.
Right. And you also learned the law, even winning a couple of times pro se, which happens basically almost never.
Yeah, I beat the MDOC like 30, 40 times now, and I just settled some more cases. I settled some diet cases and abuses for our digital content provider and some other things. So, but I do this for other prisoners. You know, I don't do this to get rich. I do this to help people. And what I do is, my rule has always been, I try to be the person for them that I needed for me when I was that young guy that was a mess and didn't have any help.
And while you helped many others, it all started with learning how to help yourself in your own legal filings. And I want to turn to Imran here. Now, we know even with evidence of all of this misconduct, exculpatory evidence, et cetera, post-conviction litigation is usually a long and winding road to nowhere, to no relief, in stark contrast to how easy it is to get wrongfully convicted. And even among a galaxy of other cases, Temujin's really stands out. Here we are, 35 years later. There are so many twists and turns, including a near turnaround moment in 2010. But even before that, there were times when what needed to happen in this case was made just painfully obvious to any objective observer.
There are, you know, probably five or six moments when this conviction could have been overturned because enough had been shown to be wrong with it. And unfortunately, all of those five or six opportunities were lost. So it starts on the direct appeal, where his direct appeal attorney is trying to obtain the original photos because he wants to be able to show that these witnesses identified Kensu through a bias lineup, that essentially police framed Kensu. And he's not given the original photos. And then ultimately, if the transcript is correct, they essentially hand him some other photos from the case and say, these are the ones. And we know they're not the ones because they had different people in them. So that direct appeal is unfortunately a failure. Then in the mid-90s is when an investigative reporter starts digging into this stuff, a guy named Bill Proctor, and he interviews jurors and he interviews some of the alibi witnesses. And most significantly, gets that videotaped recantation from the jailhouse informant, who by that time is admitting not only was he given incentives to testify against Kensu and those were not disclosed, but also is admitting that it was entirely a fabrication. So that's another moment where, you know, based on that, you could think this conviction should be reversed, but it wasn't. Then you pointed out, you know, slowly but surely we get to 2010 and a couple of important things happen there. First, Kensu, working on his own without an attorney, files a federal habeas corpus petition. And it's an absolutely massive filing because, you know, as far as he realizes, he just wants to put everything he has into it. A lawyer might say, hey, let's edit this down. Let's only keep the most salient stuff. But, you know, for Kensu, his life is on the line and he puts together this massive filing. And interestingly, that is right around the time when our innocence clinic at Michigan Law School opened, and we had started to look at this case. And we were looking at this case because even by then, Kensu had a lot of local supporters that were urging us to look at this case. We read the trial transcripts and found that this was an absolutely silly conviction, that he clearly hadn't committed this crime. So we signed on. And, you know, at the time I was a law student, so I wasn't representing Kensu, but the professors who were leading our clinic at the time signed on to be Kensu's attorneys in federal district court. You know, they intended to file amended habeas petition where they could, you know, winnow the claims to what they believed was the most important. But actually, by then, the judge had, as it turned out, already been reviewing Kensu's federal habeas, and she ended up granting it pretty quickly after we had signed on. So clearly, she hadn't really even read any new filings we made. She granted based on what Kensu had filed.
Wait, so a federal judge looked into the petition that Temujin filed pro se, and it was granted? That's incredible. So then what happened? Why did this not lead to his release?
Unfortunately, the law is very, very restrictive on this stuff. And so the state has a right to appeal that to our intermediate appellate court, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And they unfortunately reversed and upheld the conviction again. They said all of this should have been brought before, that they couldn't consider the merits of this evidence because it should have been presented earlier. So, you know, unfortunately, after that loss, a couple of other things happened. In 2010, Kensu sought clemency from the governor for the first time. He succeeded in getting a hearing. Unfortunately, clemency was denied. And there were a lot of underhanded tactics, I feel, that were used during that time, again, to just get at character assassination instead of focusing on the evidence. Clemency was denied at that time, but Herb Welser had discovered this uncropped photo lineup that showed for the first time that the witnesses had been biased by the police into selecting Mr. Kensu. So we filed a new state court filing based on that. We got a hearing on it around 2013-14. But unfortunately, the writing's on the wall every time you go to St. Clair County and talk about the Kensu case. No one's really going to give you the time of day. So we had a hearing. It was a very, very contentious hearing. And the judge ended up ruling against us. We lost the appeals on that, filed a federal habeas petition. Unfortunately, that was denied as well. The interesting thing here, of course, one of many interesting things, is that the prosecutor who had tried Kensu's case subsequently was appointed a federal judge, and now it's still a federal judge in Detroit. That's Robert Cleland. that's created kind of a whole new level of conflict in this case. When we filed his second federal habeas petition, all of the judges in the Eastern District of Michigan, which is the federal court in Detroit, all of the judges recused themselves. And Kensu's case was actually decided by a senior status, semi-retired judge in Kentucky, which, you know, is an interesting situation and not one I've come across before.
Unfortunately, that was denied as well. And so since, he has filed for clemency a few more times with subsequent Michigan governors. Now, one would think that after a federal judge agreed with his actual innocence claim and an appellate court denied him only on procedural grounds, maybe that should have held some weight in the governor's mansion, but he's been denied three times there as well. And then in 2020, Dana Nessel ran for attorney general. And all during that summer, she was riding the wave of righteous indignation about the state of law enforcement and the criminal legal system in this country. She made promises, including that they'd start a conviction integrity unit. This, of course, is the kind of thing that can go around the procedural bars that restrict relief throughout the court system. Right. But unfortunately, after reviewing this case, get this, they didn't disagree that he was innocent, but rather they changed the rules after he filed and came up with some self-imposed restriction about a need for new evidence, just like he'd needed an appellate court. So now this is the Attorney General's CIU, not the Wayne County CIU, which is widely regarded as one of the finest and most effective in the country. But this AG, Dana Nessel's CIU, has only successfully granted relief in three or four cases, and they came up with a reason to deny Temujin as well, which was to require new evidence. So since Temujin was already so thorough in his federal habeas petition, there's no currently new evidence to present. And I'm just sitting here struggling to figure out why they did this. In addition, since closing their investigation into Temujin's case, they won't even release the summary report as they've done in the past. So I can only guess, as I did earlier, that there's just such vast official misconduct in this case that admitting to the wrongdoing would be very expensive, not to mention probably highly embarrassing for some people in positions of real power. So this conviction integrity unit is now totally ignoring Temujin's innocence and doing exactly what everyone else did, of course, except for that one federal judge, Judge Hood, who alone had the courage to recognize Temujin's innocence.
So that's where we're at now. You know, believing that Kensu's 100% innocent, we're not going to give up on the case. But with each subsequent loss, there are fewer and fewer options that are still on the table. Fortunately, I think we still do have a couple of pathways left to us, thanks to the work of Herb Welser, who has done all this amazing work for him. But the craziest part of this case is he's a person who should never have been convicted at trial, and yet here we are now 35 years later, always trying to think of more and new evidence of innocence, when really all the evidence of innocence has existed in this case from the beginning.
Yeah, and it's not like this CIU has different evidence from what you've all heard here today. They've got it. So I'd hope that with an election looming, they would take bold action.
That's what I keep saying. You'd start kicking ass now so you can go out there and say, look what I just did.
I mean, this is what they campaigned on and were elected to do. And I understand that you phone banked for these people. Your new wife, Paula, since Amoco, your previous wife, had passed, Paula was literally out there knocking on doors. And then their inaction here it's made extra painful by that fact.
Right. And they made so many promises. And, Paula has been to so many rallies and listened to so many families who were waiting on that unit to do something. And they brought in amazing people like Robin Frankel and Patricia Little and Lori Montgomery and Valerie Newman, the best in this state. Great investigators, great attorneys. And nothing's coming out. And it's not because of the investigators and the attorneys. It's because something happened. I don't know if people scared her. I don't know if they told her they thought it was going to hurt her reelection chances.
How in the world can setting the innocent free be seen as anything other than a moral imperative?
Everyone agrees the innocent shouldn't be in prison. This is a pretty bipartisan issue.
So I'm sure our listeners would like to do whatever they can to right this wrong. If you're a Michigander, I've got to imagine that you're incredibly frustrated by everything you've heard on this podcast today, all this evidence. So please, we need all of you to sign the petition that's linked in the bio, and hopefully your support can help move this one over the line as it's done in other cases. And so many people have already joined this fight, including U.S. Representatives Andy Levin and Rashida Tlaib, as well as State Senator Stephanie Chang, who issued a joint statement after Temujin's denial in the CIU. I'm going to quote from that statement. They said, "We were deeply disappointed. We have great respect for the Attorney General and the other attorneys involved in this case. However, the standard used by the CIU in its review of the Kenzo case predetermined the outcome. To us, the wrong outcome. Our point of view is not based on technical or procedural flaws in the case or discovery of an alibi witness who was never presented at trial. It's based on the fact that Kenzo could not have committed and did not, in fact, commit the crime for which the state is taking away the entire rest of his life, now 35 years on. And the continued resistance to this fact of actual innocence by current and former law enforcement officials does nothing to change the fact itself." Wow. So if you're as outraged as we all are, we'll have links to action steps in the bio. So please check those out and get involved. Separately, if anyone has new information about this case, call Herb Welzer. We'll be posting his contact info as well. And now we turn to closing arguments, where I thank both of you for joining us to share your story. And then I'll turn my microphone off, kick back in my chair, and listen to whatever else you feel is left to be said. We'll kick it off with Imran. And Temujin, please take us off into the sunset.
This is one of those cases that really leaves you scratching your head, because all of the evidence that he didn't commit this crime has existed from the beginning. And so now it's just a matter of kind of acknowledging that evidence and coming to grips with it, as opposed to looking for technicalities to skirt around the evidence, which is unfortunately what the past 30 years of appeals have been. Everyone looking for an excuse not to consider the actual evidence of the case. Whether that excuse is, initially Kenzo's a manipulative person, or he's a bad guy to women in his life, or that he's the type of person who would do this. And then later it turns into, oh, you have even more evidence of innocence, but you should have presented it earlier. I think we have to look past all of this stuff. This is simply a guy who should never have been convicted. If he was to be let out tomorrow, that would be 35 years too late. There's really not a way to give him back what's happened. The only thing is that there should be an urgency to right this wrong. And I know that's the only thing he's ever wanted. So hopefully we're approaching a time, though, where we can finally come to grips with the reality of his innocence.
I want everybody to understand that we say this all the time and it becomes cliche, but your voice really does matter. We had all these protests going on a little while ago and, sadly some riots. But change was starting because of those protests. They created this great bill, this George Floyd bill. And you know what? All the protesting stopped, all the noise making stopped, the media coverage stopped, and the bill's been sitting in limbo. It's already done. They could pass that bill right now, that policing act. It's a great act. It's not unfair, and it creates necessary protections. But we stopped making noise. And when we stop making noise, they don't have to pay attention to us anymore. Or only a few of us are just crickets chirping in a field at night. It's pleasant, it's not too irritating, and it can be easily ignored, or you can enjoy whatever you want to do. And I know people have their own lives, and they have their jobs, and they have their kids, and all their responsibilities. But nothing's going to change until we demand change. Nothing's going to get any better until we stop complaining about it. Some people want things to be better, but they feel like, it's like my vote. It just doesn't matter. It's not going to change anything. It does matter, and it is going to change something. You don't have to be famous, you don't have to be wealthy, and you don't have to be connected. You just have to want things to get better. Call your senators, call your congressmen. If you're out there and you hear the story of this case, just for example, and it is one of the worst cases ever, so it's a great example, but I'm no better and no more important than anybody else who's suffering in here. But if the story moves you at all, if you say, I don't ever want to see this happen to anybody ever again, not just Mr. Kenzo, nobody, call our governor, call our attorney general, and demand that they fix this, and then demand legislation changes. If you make a deal with an informant, you have to put in writing that there was a deal, and you have to disclose everything, because there's no law saying they have to disclose anything. They have the Brady rule and disclosure, but it's so shady. Prosecutors have absolute immunity. Why? They'll tell you they can't do their jobs without immunity. That's insane. What if a doctor said, I can't do any surgery on you unless you waive all of your rights and I can leave instruments behind you and cut the wrong leg off? You cool with that? But we do this with prosecutors and judges. They don't need immunity unless they're doing something wrong.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, with research by Lila Robinson. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all three platforms. You can also follow me on both TikTok and Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.